Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen today. During this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk about democracy and freedom and the war on terror and how America is doing in maintaining our principles in light of a challenge, we say, to our principles. Our guest is Paul Street, urban social policy researcher, teacher, and writer for Z Magazine, Black Commentator, and ZNet Magazine. Also has work online at znet.org, I believe, if you'd like to look at that. Also, he's the author of several books we'll draw from during this hour, in particular one entitled Empire and Inequality, America and the World Since 9/11, published by Paradigm Publishers. He's also author of a book entitled Segregated Schools, Educational Apartheid in Post-Civil Rights America, and it's published by Routledge Press. And we'll talk about some of these things during this hour and welcome your questions. All you have to do is call us around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. I'll also mention at the outset that our guest, Paul Street, will be speaking tonight at 7 p.m. at the United Church of Christ at the corner of 6th and Daniel here in Champaign, speaking about the topic, The Repair of Broken Society Starts at Home. So that's free and open to the public if you'd like to attend. And to you, Paul Street, thanks for being here.
And thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you do your work, your research and writing in Chicago, is that correct?
Well, I'm currently based in Iowa City.
Oh, Iowa City.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, at present. You wouldn't have any reason to know that quite yet. But,
yeah.
But I've been Chicago-based and still do a lot of work in and around and about the city. In fact, I'm working on a book right now called Racial Oppression in the Global Metropolis that's very much about Chicago, which will be out with Roman Littlefield Press next year.
I wonder if you would, you know, we could start by having you talk a little bit about, you know, how, you know, your perspective on the rhetoric surrounding the response to terrorism, the terrorist attacks, the administration's policies and positions, how the rhetoric sounded, the rhetoric about defending freedom from your position looking out over, you know, the neighborhood in Chicago.
I was in an interesting place at the time the planes hit the towers, and it was a place that made me a bit skeptical about the claim that everything had changed. I was working at 45th and Michigan Avenue in the South Side, right in the heart of the historical Black ghetto. I was a research director at a nonprofit called Chicago Urban League. And there hadn't been much freedom, really, for the residents living in those communities. The particular neighborhood I was in was called Grand Boulevard, where already, and this was even still riding the wave of a great economic boom, the longest peacetime economic expansion in U.S. history, during the Clinton boom, where 40% of the kids were living in the poverty level, 25% of the kids were living at less than half of the poverty level, where people with felony records were more prevalent than legitimate jobs, where 40 to 50% of the male adults were carrying felony records. There wasn't a lot of freedom in the first place. And if anything, what changed is a lot of those conditions have gotten worse in the last few years. And I spent a fair amount of time documenting that.
Now, you write about these things in this book that we've mentioned, Empire and Inequality, American in the World Since 9/11. There are so many things that we could talk about. I wonder if, you know, there are six themes that you basically pursue, and maybe we can just kind of take these up. That you know, there are a number of people, and I suppose as people who debate the politics of all this may disagree on certain things. For example, there are certain people who are critics of the Bush administration, think that 9/11 was a big conspiracy to essentially pursue what their agenda was. That's a little bit out there. There are others who think that we need to be completely pursuing the kinds of security measures, clamping down on the borders, a variety of security-oriented measures with regard to policy in pursuit of the war on terror. And certainly, either way you slice that, it seemed that the events argued for the response that the Bush administration took. At least they essentially said, this is the agenda we're going to pursue. Your argument is that that was their agenda in the first place.
You know, I'm not personally much on conspiracy theories, mm-hmm. particularly about 9/11. I don't think Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney ordered this. I don't think there was a lot of direct, I don't think there was U.S. direct engagement. I do think that 9/11 was a great opportunity, and more than Washington and the Bush administration will ever admit, beneath all their claims of solemn reverence for 9/11 victims, was a welcome occasion for, you know, a very significant deepening of control domestically, and was seized upon as such. There was a number of people in key policymaking positions in the Bush administration, including Cheney, including Rumsfeld, who were both members of an organization called the Project for a New American Century, that produced a very interesting document called Rebuilding America's Defenses in 2000, which argued for, among other things, an invasion of Iraq, for an aggressive advance of a preemptive war doctrine, for a deepening of American control over strategic Middle Eastern Arab supplies. There's a very interesting line. This doesn't make me a conspiracy theorist. Mm-hmm. In there about what we're, in essence, what we'll need in order to carry out this agenda is what they refer to as a new Pearl Harbor. Well, they got it. And I don't think they were directly engaged in making it happen. I don't buy conspiracy assumptions. And if you know, if anyone wanted to know more in detail about why I don't, we certainly could do that. Even as the ruins of the Pentagon and the World Trade Centers were still smoldering, the agenda we now know was just clearly already being enacted to create a scenario and to try and get the American people in a place where they would at least acquiesce in a monumentally illegal and immoral and provocative and inciting occupation of Iraq.
The question was raised after 9/11 by many. Why do they hate us? And the response typically seemed to go, because of our freedom and democracy.
You don't have to be a leftist critique of American empire, and as I suppose one could accurately describe me, to have not been surprised, given U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, whether you're talking about just consistent siding with Israel and against the Palestinians, or whether you were talking about U.S. troops being provocatively based in Saudi Arabia, or whether you were talking about the deadly sanctions campaign that the U.S. was leading against Iraq, you did not need to be a leftist to take a look at those policies. A good friend of mine, I remember about a year before 9/11, sitting around and having a couple beers with a Republican friend of mine in DeKalb, Illinois, where I was at the time. Both of us in fundamental agreement that sometime fairly soon there was going to be some sort of very significant terrorist attack on the United States, motivated by U.S. policies. Freedom as the objective. If a simple hostility to democratic freedoms and to relatively open civil society, into modern social protections and all the kinds of things that we, you know, quite rightly prize in modern democratic industrialized societies, was the issue, then why the United States? Why wasn't Stockholm attacked? Why wasn't why wasn't the assault on Frankfurt, or why wasn't it Paris that was attacked? Why did we all kind of know somewhere, or many of us at least, sort of inside our bones, that there was particularly a likely attack on the United States of America? Because of this very significant foreign policy presence and this very kind of selective designation of certain people as our allies and other people as our enemies over there. It wasn't particularly surprising.
After 9/11, you write that you were somewhat optimistic that we would have a debate about these, about the issues, about our place in the world, and about, what what it is, the issues that you sort of touched upon there that we need to do. We didn't have that debate. What would that debate look like? What would that debate be about?
Well, it would have been about U.S. policy. It would have been about support for. I'll be careful. To some extent, there was a significant uptick in an interest, even in left analyses of our policy after 9/11. As a matter of fact, number of critical books, including Noam Chomsky's speeches and writings collected in a volume called 9/11, and a few other books actually sold fairly well, and there was some of that opening in a way. People became curious in a way that they hadn't been before. But I'd say it fairly quickly got trumped by the drumbeat of patriotic sort of mind-closing, us or them, sort of blind patriotism, encouraging everyone to cower under the national security umbrella and sort of look to Big Brother and Washington to protect us and to think for us and to carry out policies for us. And what I think it would have looked like would have been to make a really sort of critical appraisal and to take an honest look at the way we were, quite frankly, oppressing and deepening inequality in the Middle East and, in fact, in other parts of the world, and trying to make some connections between that overseas agenda, the sanctions agenda, the close alliance with the occupation regime that Israel had been carrying out, still is, and making connections between all of that and some of our domestic policies, which are quite problematic and tend to go unmentioned in all this discussion of world events, as we're claiming to be exporting freedom across the world and claiming to want to export democracy and freedom, which is questionable. But also in my book, I'm trying to question our qualifications, to be perfectly honest with you, to export that in the first place. There's a lot of interesting questions about whether we really possess all of that freedom and all of that democracy to the extent that we say we do, that we're really in that position to export societal benevolence and freedom and democracy and all those good things. So I think it would involve taking a really honest look at how we treat the Arab world, which is a fairly arrogant form of treatment and quite explicitly imperial. And we would have connected that back to some of the unmet social needs, the list of which just goes on and on and on in this country.
We're talking this morning with Paul Street. He's an urban social policy researcher, teacher, and writer, author of several books, including one we're drawing from during this hour, Focus 580, Empire and Inequality, America and the World Since 9/11. If you would like to join our conversation, you are welcome to do so. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. The one of the issues that has sort of been buried in the war on terror, as we like to call it, has been the development of our own infrastructure, education, healthcare, a variety of issues at home that relate very directly to the things that you sort of were touching upon, and that is the state of our own civil society and democracy. Do you see any hope in the current election cycle and the debate that's happening and, the political dimension of the electoral process, that those issues are, especially, we had Hurricane Katrina that seemed to raise some of these issues. Do you see any light on those issues?
Well, it remains to be seen, and these are very pivotal midterm elections that are coming out right now. It's complex. I think that there's a feeling in the country right now of a mass citizenry sort of waking up from a 5-year hangover, and being much more skeptical about the opportunistic uses of 9/11 not to mention turning against, in essence, 60% of the population now polls against the occupation of Iraq. There is now a majority of the population that refuses to type, despite the administration's insistent attempt to continue to make this connection, to accept the notion that Al-Qaeda and Saddam and Iraq were connected to one another. There's a distinction between the war on terror and the war on Iraq in the population that's now made by the majority of the population. There's now a majority of the population that is calling for a timetable for withdrawal. There is now a majority of the population that wants to see troops reduced from Iraq before the end of the year. All of which, by the way, are things that the Bush administration is saying they're not going to implement. Even at the same time, they're saying that they're advancing a model of democracy based on honoring the will of the people in the Middle East. There is a number of anti-war candidates that have started to make some steps forward in Democratic primaries. There is a guy in Connecticut named Ned Lamont who felt compelled to make connection between the imperial defense budget, which is just over the top, and the underfunding of social programs, the underfunding of schools in the United States of America. And there's actually an undercurrent on issues, specifically on issues, of progressive sentiment in this country, majority sentiment, that goes back long before this year, that goes back to the 20th century, and it continues up to this day, of people who would prefer to see their government representing their nation honor international law, honor the Geneva Conventions, honor the Kyoto Accords against global warming, who feel that military corporations and other corporations have undue influence and power in the American political system. Clear preponderant majorities would like to see a national health care system in this country. And just consistently, again and again, American people in polling data put social needs and domestic needs, health, education, and welfare above military so-called defense expenditures in their list of where they'd like to see their money spent. So there's a sentiment out there that's really quite progressive on issues that's been there for a while. And whether it's going to break through the blockade of fear and blind patriotism, and whether it's going to get through not just past what I would call the Republican fear campaign, but get if it's going to push and motivate the sort of confused and incoherent and fragmented Democratic Party and move them in any particular kind of way is really one of the great questions of the 21st century. And we're gonna take a little bit of a look at where we're at in these upcoming elections. They could be very interesting. There's a there's in polling in national surveys now, very preponderant majority of the country would like to see the current in power war party in power, the respectable right. I always call it the so-called conservative party because I think we sort of have a form of the radical right in power. We'd like to see them out of office right now. And it's going to be very interesting to see whether people can and will actually act on that desire and whether they really feel that there's any kind of alternative out there whatsoever. The Democrats are consciously pursuing a policy of just sort of letting the Republicans sink themselves and shoot themselves in the foot, and they're thinking that they can say relatively little and just sort of garner the benefits of the windfall of Republican self-immolation. Whether that's going to work or not, I'm fairly dubious about.
We have a caller to talk with. Let's do that. Someone on a cell phone, line number one. Good morning.
Yes, hello, and I'm enjoying your comment. I'm very cynical about the country's direction, and I was listening yesterday to CNN, which I think is a disguised Fox, and they mentioned that Bush's ratings were steady at 44%, and my heart dropped because I'm trying to think of what 44% of the population that was polled scientifically would appreciate or affirm what Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and the neocons are doing to this country. I'm very disheartened by Bush having at least 44%. And I must also say that, as Will Rogers, I believe, once said, I'm a member of a disorganized political party. I'm a Democrat. And therefore, I'm very disheartened about the Democrat strategy of just sort of waiting for the Republicans to shoot them in the foot. I'm not sure if the American people won't give the Republicans another victory in the November elections. I'd like your thoughts on that.
You know, I keep hearing different numbers on Bush's approval level. I've heard 44%, and then I read recently, I think it was in the New York Times, high 30s. I think he did get a little bit of a boost. It's sort of unfortunate the way our public relations and political system works right now, that literally just filling up airtime. He's given, 9, 10 speeches, basically pushing the panic button and leading with fear. Vote for us or Islamo-fascist terrorists will be running around in the streets and slaughtering everybody and cower. Cower now, you know. And it may have pushed him up a little bit. The Republicans have more money. I'm in Iowa City right now, and I tell you, I see slicker and better and more heavily researched ads by all the Republican candidates than I'm seeing by the Democrats. I'm sort of seeing these Democratic ads, which are sort of putting the Republican enemy next to a picture of Bush, associating with him and saying, you don't want this guy to be like Bush, and then it's sort of the end of the ad. Whereas the Republican ads are really, you can tell, they've dug up. It's terrible. I mean, it's slimy, and they're digging up dirt, but you can tell they've really done research, and they're really sort of going for the jugular. That's one thing. The other thing is the way the congressional districts are drawn in this country, which no one seems to talk very much about, but they're heavily gerrymandered, and the Democrats helped participate along in that process themselves over the last 20 years in such a ways that makes it very difficult for challengers to defeat incumbents. And that's problematic as well. I think the biggest problem is for all the unpopularity of the core Republican agenda on issues, they get a lot of points with people because they're at least very clear about what they're about. So, and at the same time that people actually on issues seem to prefer the Democratic Party, they also tell pollsters they can't identify exactly what the party stands for. And if you look at, for example, on the Iraq War, they're just really truly all over the map. There are some people who will have the courage and the guts to actually call for troops out now, and which is sort of Lamont's position in Connecticut. And there's others who are actually sort of almost trying to outflank the Republican Party from the right. They're stay-the-course Democrats. But mainly there's this kind of wishy-washy sort of Obama kind of position where you're just sort of hanging there and hoping nobody really calls you on it, and you can just sort of benefit. I don't know if the electorate really responds to that. I think they like forceful positions, and this is the great flaw of the Democratic Party these days.
We're talking during this hour, Focus 580, with Paul Street, urban social policy researcher, teacher, and writer, author of several books, including one we're talking about during this hour, "Empire and Inequality: America and the Wars in the World Since 9/11." And we have a couple callers waiting. If you'd like to join us, I'll mention the phone numbers again, 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Also, I'll mention again that our guest Paul Street is speaking tonight in Champaign-Urbana at the United Church of Christ on the corner of 6th and Daniel in Champaign, 7 p.m. tonight. And that is free and open to the public, so if you'd like to attend that, you certainly can. We'll go on and talk with some more listeners. Next up, someone in Champaign County, line number 2. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I wanted you to talk about what you've written or what you've researched about the whole cause of the war. There's some sentiment in the air that, okay, they may have exaggerated, but it was just because they wanted to, fulfill their democracy urge or something that is unanalyzed, apparently. It seems to me that one of the things that happened right after the war was Bremer got in and put in a flat tax and wiped away all the contracts that the Iraq had signed with Russia and France and all these other governments, and now who's getting those contracts? It seems to, and maybe that's too crude, which reminds me of this essay called Crude Designs that you may have read that talks about production sharing agreements and how one of the things they're doing is they're privatizing the oil in Iraq without calling it privatization. They've been very careful to say that they're not privatizing the oil, but the kind of sleight of hand they're using is these productive sharing agreements. And I'm so sick of hearing it's their impulse to democracy that they wanted to remake the Middle East in a democratic fashion, when it's actually the worrying about where the oil contracts are going was probably more preeminent in their mind. So thank you.
No, that's a great question. You know, Bush actually earlier this year, I was just talking with a friend of mine recently about it's exhausting to even try and keep track of the deceptions that come out of the White House. It's a full-time job. You can sort of go blind just trying to track it all down. One of the big ones was this earlier this year in the last spring, Bush actually announced that we didn't invade Iraq because of weapons of mass destruction at all. That wasn't it. And, you know, I went back and I looked at all the, it was democracy promotion. It's all about our quest for liberty and to expand the sphere of freedom in the world. And, of course, we're the homeland and headquarters of modern freedom. And I went back and I looked at the presidential radio addresses and all the presidential addresses, which are available off of the United States White House website. In February and March 2003, as we're leading up to the war. And let me tell you, it's the thing they lead with more than anything else is WMD, weapons of mass destruction, and all kinds of sleight of hand connections and references in connecting those alleged non-existent, which we supposedly found out only later that they were non-existent, but in fact any number of people, including Scott Ritter, knew they were not, and even myself with my lack of any background in WMD investigation skills, knew it was just a complete charade. But it's exactly what they were leading with, and it's exactly what they're talking about. And the democracy objective is sort of patched on as, oh, this is really the reason we did this, in an ex post facto kind of way, only after it becomes entirely clear that there were no WMD. You know, I was going to say, you know, and at the same time, WMD were recurrently connected in sort of subtle kinds of ways, but constant kinds of ways, battering the electorate over the head with it, were connected to alleged relationships between Saddam and al-Qaeda and 9/11 and all that kind of stuff, and, you know, the real terrorist threat. So they added that on later. Now, you know, if democracy is the real objective, then why Iraq, right? There are any number of parts of a vastly authoritarian, dictatorial, non-democratic world that you could go. I mean, for example, Saudi Arabia would be a good place. You know, one of the most openly, transparently feudal, monarchical, and backwards nations on earth. They just happen to be a close ally of ours, and they're a close ally of ours because we have secure access to their oil, and that goes back, of course, more than half a century. You know, there's this. It's just a childish fairy tale. And unfortunately, a lot of Democrats seem to buy into it. And so you hear criticisms to the effect of, you know, you're just not going to be able to export Jeffersonian democracy to Iraq, and you might as well give up on trying to do that, as if that really were the objective. As if we would be, you know, it's like Noam Chomsky says, it's a childish fairy tale. You know, it's as if we would be invading Iraq if their main raw material was peaches or soybeans or nutmeg or something like that. Anyone who thinks that the fact that Iraq sits on simply spectacular oil reserves and the fact that Iraq itself is right at the heart of a spectacularly oil strategic region of the world, that isn't a key factor in why we're there, is just living in a fantasy world, as far as I'm concerned. The only reason the Middle East is so powerfully on our foreign policy radar screen, and has been for some time, maybe I shouldn't say the only reason, but it's clearly one of the key shaping factors, is this simply super strategic material prize that they've got there, which isn't simply just about filling up our SUVs and being able to drive our eight-cylinder gas-guzzling vehicles, six-cylinder vehicles around at relatively low cost. It's also about this enormous power that having leverage in that region confers upon an imperial nation, the leverage that it gives the United States over the rest of the world. And that leverage is a very big issue for the United States right now, given the rising economic power of others of other zones in the world economy. So, I mean, I think you're right. I think you're right to be deeply skeptical of that democracy ambition and to point to oil and even get into some of the very specific policy things that you were talking about.
We have another caller waiting, and we'll go on to them. Let me mention the phone number again if you'd like to join us. Our guest, Paul Street, author of the book Empire and Inequality, America and the World Since 9/11, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana, toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. And Urbana listener next, line number one. Good morning.
Hello. Yes, Mr. Street, I think you made a couple of misjudgments. One, you cite Clinton's long-term economic prosperity, when in fact the undercurrents of the economic debacles of the bankruptcy, the multi-billion dollar bankruptcies of WorldCom and Enron were during his tenure, and they should have, if we had known, they would have been detracted from the GDP, not added to it, and they didn't really come to light until after Clinton left office. Now, secondly, people say there's no relationship to al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, but this ignores the fact that both parties hated Americans. Saddam sat at the economic jugular of the world's oil supply because 60% of the world's oil supply passes through the Strait of Hormuz. Plus, he had multi-billion dollars to buy weapons of mass destruction, nuclear or otherwise. And if he would have attained such fissionable material, I'm sure he would have been eager to give them to al-Qaeda for a mass destruction event in the United States.
Okay. On the first one, I think actually you may misunderstand my point. I think I made a reference simply in a passing way to the fact that there was a remarkable period of continuous economic expansion under Clinton. And that's true. I mean, and I'm not a fan of Clinton domestic policy or Clinton economic policy at all. I think you're quite right to point out that the recession which came later was in many ways overdue. In fact, I always refer to the recession, which technically started before 9/11 in 2000, as the Clinton-Bush recession. And there actually were things. There's a wonderful book by a University of Massachusetts Amherst economist named Robert Pollan called Contours of Dissent, where he talks about, the, among other things, the failure of the Clinton administration to implement some sort of basic sort of controls to put some regulations on that might have dealt with some of those issues that ended up with the WorldCom situation and the Enron situation. So that's true. There were real problems with the Clinton economic policy, and those chickens did come home to roost on large extent under Bush. I think at one level there might be a misunderstanding about what I was saying, and then we have an agreement there. I mean, we have a real disagreement on your second point. It's even a matter now that's acknowledged at the higher levels of U.S. intelligence. There was a congressional report out recently. Saddam and al-Qaeda, not only was not associated with al-Qaeda, but there was real hostility between them. For all his flaws, he was relatively sort of secular and not particularly Islamic fundamentalist, and these guys viewed each other as blood enemies. I absolutely guarantee you that he would not have handed off any fissionable material, which he was, of course, eons away from ever having in the first place. But the notion of handing that stuff off to al-Qaeda or other extreme Islamic terrorist groups is just flatly false, in my opinion. Insofar as they say, hated America, there was a hatred of U.S. policy that was shared across both the Hussein regime and al-Qaeda. And in Saddam's case, the reasons for it were not particularly surprising. I mean, it's understood that a million or more Iraqis, including half a million Iraqi children or more, died due to these really deadly economic sanctions that were nominally imposed by the United Nations and really led by the United States during and after the Gulf War. And the Gulf War, incidentally, was a highly murderous occasion which led to hundreds of thousands of Iraqi deaths as well. And certainly, you know, I'm sure bin Laden and others of his ilk hope to exploit some of that hatred that Iraqis had. But handing off a fictional WMD to Al-Qaeda is itself a fiction.
Hopek is the caller's points. We will go on next to someone on a cell phone on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
I have always, kind of gone along with U.S. policy on the Arab-Israeli agreement. But over the last several years, I've begun to question what we're getting out of our relationship with Israel. And, you know, when you say that in some groups, it's like you're attacking the United States. But it just seems to me like, people say, well, they're a democracy. Well, you know, not like our democracy. I mean, they don't have religious freedom there. They, you know, the Palestinian people are treated like dirt. And I also think about, you know, what would happen if the United Nations came to the United States and said, look, you're going to have to give back Illinois to the Native Americans. And then, you know, there was some superpower that would enforce that. And how would we look at that superpower? And I'm beginning to wonder if it's time that we take a good hard look at our relationship with Israel and force them to settle with the Palestinian people in an equitable fashion. Not that I want Israel to come to an end tomorrow, or ever, for that matter. But I think the Palestinian people deserve a place at the table also. And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
Well, there are some real interesting points about insofar as the United States is so critically and crucially and understandably obsessed with oil issues in the Middle East, at what point does one question this relationship that you're talking about when it so endangers and enrages, infuriates people? There's a kind of embargo in American media, literally down to the images you see, not to mention the content of print articles, to ever really take an honest and serious look at Palestinian life. There's just this kind of vague sense out there that there are these angry Arabs, and for mysterious reasons, they're just really kind of ticked off. And they're sort of vaguely understood to be anti-Semitic. They must have just woke up one day and just become anti-Semitic. It's just because out of religious issues or racial issues or some combination of both. If you want to take a look at maps and take a look at the socioeconomic statistics in Palestine and compare them with those in Israel, and it's really a situation of people under just desperate living circumstances, just in massive unemployment, and just shocking levels of poverty, living in third world conditions, in ghettoized, informal living arrangements, literally oftentimes just barely scratching to get by. And of course, now things are worse after Hamas was elected, because the so-called international community, which is usually a catchphrase for the United States, imposing all these sorts of developmental aid sanctions and so forth, and essentially right next door, geographically speaking, to people living relatively affluent European and American first world lifestyles. I might add that Israel itself is becoming increasingly regressive, and now over the last 20 years, with its militarization, has become one of the more unequal industrialized modern democratic societies in the world, and something that's having a negative impact on its own democracy. But I think you raise some very very real concerns, and one can talk about these concerns without arguing for the abolition of Israel as a state. And we can talk intelligently about two-state solutions and something a little better for the Palestinian people than what we have right now, which is kind of a South African regime of balkanized apartheid and extreme socioeconomic subordination for them.
We have several callers waiting, and we'll go on next to a listener in Savoy on line number 3. Good morning.
Hello. My call is either to agree nor disagree with the guest. Some of the things the guest has said, I think, are accurate and well said. Other things, I think, are too much on the manipulative and slicing his pie very carefully kind of concept. I would like to mention two additional ideas. By the way, I've cut in and out of your broadcast, so I don't know if these have come up or not. But
okay, well, go ahead.
Not. The oil idea for Iraq, those are plausible, of course, but I remember during the Vietnam War, the American War in Vietnam, there were several, you know, there were all kinds of talks about how there were these great supplies offshore and we were really there for that, et cetera, et cetera. And there were maps published and everything. Either it's not happened or the media has once again not kept us up to date on other realities. But I don't think there's been any great exploration and mining, let's call it, of oil reserves off Vietnam. The other idea is the president of Pakistan was on 60 Minutes, I think it was. Anyway, some show this weekend. And it seems pretty obvious to me that if A.Q. Khan et al. Sold the necessary ingredients to North Korea and to Iran, that given the eventual negation of the sanctions against Iraq, and it seems pretty apparent that the French and the Russians were going to vote in line with that, then after a few months of quiet carefulness, Saddam Hussein would have been able to do business with A.Q. Khan. So whatever our original reasons were for going into Iraq, I think on balance it at least stopped that sale from going ahead and apparently stopped Libya from continuing on too. So these are important ideas that I think your audience should hear as well.
Okay, well, thanks for the call. Do you want to respond?
Well, I did a piece, a three-part piece on ZNet, www.zmag.org. If you go on the Internet and Google my name, Paul Street, plus really pithy title, Iraq is not Vietnam, I address that. I suppose people, I think this was sort of near the end of the Vietnam situation, did talk about offshore oil. But I don't think that really, I don't... There was very little raw materials that were particularly relevant in the world economic system in Vietnam. Those were different concerns. If anyone was relating oil as a motive to U.S. policy in Vietnam, then that would have been nothing but pure fantasy. There was a very real concern that they had, which they were trying to crush an independent nationalist left peasant social revolution, which concerned U.S. policymakers for very, in some ways, rational reasons. And they talked about it, and in some ways they said pretty much what their concerns were, and it wasn't too hard to decode what they meant. It was what they called their domino theory, which they framed as an attempt to stop the encroaching conspiracy of international communism, and which was really sort of something else, but there was a very real fear of an independent nationalist revolution breaking out of the world system and inspiring people all over the world. That may be inspiring people to do similar things in parts of the world that really did have strategic raw materials. Iraq really does have simply stupendous stockpiles of oil, many of them untapped and still waiting to come into play. Or maybe the point is to sort of keep them from not coming into play for other more advanced economic states that are threatening us. And I can't comment much because I don't know much about what the potential would have been of Iraq developing a connection at some point in some hypothetical future down the line with the Pakistani nuclear proliferator whose name I'm forgetting right now that you mentioned. The United States is not particularly distinguishing itself as an enemy of nuclear proliferation right now, and is sort of making the argument for becoming a nuclear state to third world states, it seems to me, by the occupation of Iraq. One of the things I would look at if I was a third world nation trying to come up in the world and looking at the divergent fate of North Korea versus that of Iraq is, I think, maybe, you know, and if also I was sort of looking at the deal the United States was cutting with India on nuclear weapons and nuclear power, I might be trying, I might be reasoning, at least it wouldn't be completely insane to think that, that my logical conclusion would be I better get myself a nuclear weapon quick, fast, and in a hurry.
We have another call to talk with. I think somebody wanted to follow up on a previous question. Line number one, Champaign County. Good morning.
Hi. Yeah, well, I wanted the doctor's question about Vietnam to be a little, and your speaker has pointed out, it's not just the development of oil, it's control of oil. It's the there is a lot of offshore oil off the, in the South China Sea, and it, I think it was part of the grand area planning that the U.S. was. But if you keep it off the market, that's helpful, too, for a lot of the powers that be. And it's amazing that 40% of the population apparently believes that the market's being manipulated right now just before the election. So and I think they're probably right. Thanks. That's all I wanted.
Okay. Thanks.
Well, I'll pick up on one point there, which is it's not – it's often cited as a great failure of the Rumsfeld-Cheney invasion that that the oil that was supposedly going to pay for the invasion never really actually came online. But if the objective is more about control than just getting cheap oil and just feeding her, which, and I agree with the caller, that that's a critical aspect of it. And anyone's interested in more sort of detailed argument about that, there's a book that came out about the time the war started called The New Imperialism by David Harvey, where he really gets in a very detailed kind of way about that motive. If it's more about control, it's actually more about the concern that other up-and-coming and more, shall we say, efficient trading and production zones in the economy, particularly East Asia, and to some extent the Europeans, are going to utilize cheap Middle Eastern oil and finance their own expansion with it, then it might actually be functional from an American imperial perspective to at least stop that stuff from going online. And I'll tell you, they have very little interest, U.S. policymakers, that is, in either party of getting out of there anytime soon. Anyone who thinks they're just going to they're building 14 military permanent bases in or thereabouts in Iraq, right? Anyone who thinks that these guys are thinking seriously about just letting Iraq cut any deal they want with all that oil with, let's say, China, for example, is probably thinking in sort of fantastic terms.
We literally have 2 minutes left. I wonder if you would say something about the idea of American exceptionalism being a sort of, I mean, we like to think of America as special. The United States has a special place in history, a destiny, if you will. But this also sort of, you know, frames the way that we remember or don't remember things. Like, for example, that Saddam Hussein was our guy for a while, and that we, you know, deposed the leader of Iran, Mossadegh, and basically installed the Shah of Iran, and sort of those chickens then came home to roost. We don't remember those things. They don't fit into that narrative.
Well, Orwell said, "Those who control the present control the past, or and in turn control the future." I know I just butchered the quote, but. Amnesia, I taught history for years, and history, among other things, is intellectual self-defense. Rulers appeal to it all the time to get you to go along with something. And when you don't know, and people, I'm sorry to say, except very few individuals who are lucky enough to have a good high school history teacher, and still most the majority of the adult population just has a high school, has a high school degree. When you just don't know that we actually deposed, you know, the sitting elected leader of Guatemala in 54, that we were involved in this coup that you just mentioned in Iran, and so on and so forth, and just fill in the blank. When you don't know that history and you've just sort of been told, you have no context, and you really are just completely mystified by overseas attitudes and sometimes, you know, horrible and criminal overseas behaviors. I mean, 9/11 was a great crime. people tell me, and I say it wasn't surprising, they accuse you of apologizing for it. Not at all. It's a monumental crime. And yet not particularly surprising to me, but not surprising to me. And I mentioned a friend of mine who's a Republican, not surprising to, his name was Doug, Doug at the time either. Because one thing Doug and I had in common, despite our ideological differences, we knew some history.
Well, that's a good point to end on, and we're out of time, so we'll have to do that. Let me mention again our guest, Paul Street, author of the book Empire and Inequality, America and the World Since 9/11, among other writings, including on ZNet.org. He will be speaking tonight at the United Church of Christ, 7 p.m., that's in Champaign, corner of 6th and Daniel, and you're welcome to attend that if you would like to hear more from our guest. And Paul Street, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.